The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. And New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Shartok. With us this week and so many other weeks because we love him is Blair Horner, the Executive Director of the New York Public Interest Research Group, NYPIRG. Welcome back, Blair.
Thanks for having me, Alan. Good talking to you.
Okay, so let's start. Lieutenant Governor Brian Benjamin has now resigned. Is the governor responsible for not vetting him properly? But what happens here? She obviously could have done a better job of picking a running mate.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of staggering when you think about it, right? Even a simple Google search would have identified that this guy had some problems. So I don't know what happened. I mean, you know, I mean, I assume to some extent he fibbed when he was asked about this in a press conference prior to his resignation. He said he answered all the questions he was asked, which may mean that if they didn't ask him a specific question like, are you under investigation by the feds, that he didn't have to answer? So, I mean, it's a colossal failure on the governor's part. I mean, I don't know who was in charge of this, but a Google search might have raised some flags that they obviously didn't catch.
Well, obviously, this is now a difficult thing to analyze because the governor must have relied on somebody else to make the recommendation for Brian Benjamin, right? I mean, that's why you have staff. So I'm assuming somebody's getting their behind kicked right now.
Well, you would think. Again, when you go into state government, the executive service, there's a background check investigation that occurs, usually through the state police. So there's that aspect of it. Then I assume that there's some sort of person in the governor's office directly who, you know, interviews the potential candidates. And Benjamin was advanced by somebody to the governor. It wasn't like the governor just picked him out of a hat. So, again, the reporting on this particular problem about the illegal campaign contributions emerged during his failed run for New York City comptroller. So it wasn't like this was a closely held secret. And I think it was probably the reporting that triggered the feds to look into it. But, you know, if you become governor because your predecessor resigns in scandal, you want to be as pure as you can be in terms of your administration. And Benjamin had flags that were flying well in advance of the governor picking him to be lieutenant governor. And so it's blown up in her face.
So Blair, in the beginning, she was getting at least fair marks. 50% of the people said they liked her. They thought she was good. Does this really hurt her?
Well, you know, we live in an age where there's a once in a century pandemic and a war in Europe. So how much New Yorkers are paying attention to who the lieutenant governor is? Who knows? But, you know, on top of there was some miscues when she was wrapping up the budget in terms of how that all played out. And I think the governor has to be careful that she doesn't develop some sort of reputation for problems in her administration. And I mean, you're right that she may end up saddled with somebody as the lieutenant governor running mate going into November, who she doesn't even have any affiliation with at all. So this is all very murky for her and creates real problems and headaches. Now, again, at the end of the day, you know who the lieutenant governor is? Unless the governor, you know, decides not to be the governor anymore, doesn't matter a whole heck of a lot in Albany.
Well, Blair Horner, that last thing you said brings on a little bit of Beethoven in my mind. After all, we do know that Hochul ascended from a who-she to the governorship because Andrew Cuomo got into so much trouble. So the question is, how important is the lieutenant governor in your mind?
Well, I mean, you know, obviously a top-ranking official within state government, and the lieutenant governor has important responsibilities within the government. But how important is a function of how much the governor wants to include him or her in sort of the cabinet-style system that they may run? Governor Andrew Cuomo kept, you know, Kathy Hochul, I wouldn't say at arm's length, maybe, you know, miles length away from the inner circle. How Hochul dealt with Benjamin, I don't really know. I mean, their relationship really didn't get a chance to sort of get off the ground. But, you know, we've seen this in the past. There have been lieutenant governors who primaried their gubernatorials, the governor's choice. So, for example, Mario Cuomo, as you may recall, ended up with a lieutenant governor who was not his choice because his choice, Carl McCall, lost in the primary. And so there are instances where it happens. But again, unless the governor chooses to involve the lieutenant governor in a significant way within policymaking or politics, or the governor resigns or leaves office for whatever reason, the lieutenant governor's job is largely ceremonial and not a big factor in policymaking.
So Andrew Cuomo didn't have a great relationship, as you hint here, with Kathy Hochul. So there's got to be a better way of doing this succession business, doesn't there?
Well, you know, this is what it is, right? I mean, we have it at the federal level. It's the same thing. You know, the president, if the president leaves office for whatever reason, the vice president becomes president. That's sort of the system we have. I mean, if you are choosing a running mate to sort of balance the ticket, either regionally, ethnically, gender, whatever. I mean, Andrew Cuomo was looking for a female running mate at the time when he was facing Cynthia Nixon and Zephyr Teachout as his opponents in various primaries. I mean, if you do that and you're not really thinking about them as your successor or as an important part of the team, then you end up with, you know, the lieutenant governor being sort of largely ceremonial position, and they're out, you know, in the hinterlands cutting ribbons at the opening of, you know, rec centers, which is what Kathy Hochul did. But, you know, it's really up to the governor. It is the governor who, after all, we vote for in the fall. It is a unified ticket. I mean, you could have lieutenant governors running separately in the fall, and that might then mean that you have a lieutenant governor who has to prove broad-based public support. But if you do that, then you could create a potential rivalry, and that's why they run as a unified ticket. So I think it's a reasonable way to do it. It's really up to whoever becomes governor to use the lieutenant governor effectively.
Now we have, of course, Kathy Hochul, who Blair Horner is a Buffaloian or a Niagarian, and so the question is: does New York tolerate people from other than the big city?
Well, tolerate, yes, but there hasn't been a statewide governor elected from upstate. I can't even remember the name of the person. It was about 100 years ago, a guy from Glens Falls. So it doesn't happen very often. Financial center of the planet, the biggest, most important city in the country is in New York, New York City, and that is where the political heavyweights are. And so, you know, we've generally had downstate governors for a long time, certainly in modern times, post-World War II, and that's, you know, because that's where the money is. And the way American politics works out is, you know, you follow the money. And Wall Street's down in New York City, so there's tremendous wealth in the city. And people are, you know, rubbing elbows with the high and mighty when it comes to money. And that is, you know, that generates political power. And I don't think it's a tolerate issue. I think it's a pure mechanics of how do you get elected issue. How do you have the money? How do you have the contacts? How do you raise your visibility in New York City? If you can do all those things, if you can make it in New York City, you can make it anywhere. I think that applies as well to people running for governor. Now, again, George Pataki wasn't from New York City, but he was from the sort of the northern suburbs of New York City. And so it's, you know, it's entirely possible that someone upstate can get elected. We're about to test that, I guess, this June in a primary, and November, if she gets the nomination, in the general.
Okay, and of course, she's a woman, I have to point out, and that's the first woman who's been the governor.
That's right.
So how important is that?
I think it's huge. I mean, she has certainly wrapped herself in it. She's most of her top staff are female. She wore the white dress, the suffragette white dress, in her State of the State message. She talks about it all the time. I think she's proud of the fact that she's been able to do what she's done. And I think that it resonates politically, particularly among older women who tend to vote. And so I think it's a huge advantage for her, as long as it doesn't evaporate due to, you know, some, at the moment, unforeseen circumstance.
So where does this leave Andrew Cuomo? That's the next question, obviously. You worked for him for a short amount of time. Mm-hmm. I've known him for a long time, interviewed him many, many, many times. This is a guy of tremendous ambition, and you can just see him circling around, smelling the air. So where do you think he is right now, and what do you think his expectations are? After all, he did buy that ad on the television that everybody saw. Everybody said, well, he's after something.
Well, I mean, you're right. I worked for him for a little over a year when he was attorney general. But I can't say that I'm inside his head. I mean, I would assume that if you're looking for any political rehabilitation, you first have to rehabilitate your public image. And that seems to be where he's focusing. I mean, he has real vulnerabilities. The book deal is still out there. And if there's an effort by the state to claw the money back because they found, and the impeachment investigation found, that he used public resources for his $5 million book, which is a no-no. He's also vulnerable to, you know, the sort of the ongoing onslaught of allegations from the women who allege that he harassed them. And so he's still vulnerable. He has to be very careful about how he moves. But I think it's more about, it seems anyway, about rehabilitating his image and maybe settling some scores with the $18 million, probably now $16 million war chest, which makes it probably the biggest political action committee in the state. So he has the ability to sort of influence events. But again, I don't know what his plan is. Certainly he could try to petition his way onto the ballot, and given the right circumstances, he might. But taking on the first woman governor in New York State, that seems like a bad political move.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about that other big story that we have been covering, and that's the budget. Put it mildly, what do you like, what don't you like in the budget?
Well, I hated the way it was done. It was Albany at its worst. It was all secretive. Deals were hammered out in secret. Hundreds of millions of dollars were changing hands for backroom deals, probably not smoke-filled because you're not allowed to have smoke-filled rooms anymore. But it was really the curtains were drawn. The public didn't know what was going on. Many lawmakers didn't know what was going on. And then the budget deals were rammed through with special messages and necessity from the governor. So the bills didn't even have any time to sort of be publicly reviewed by anybody.
Will you remind everybody what the message of necessity is? It's so important. Go ahead.
Yeah, the state constitution says that bills have to be sitting on the legislators' desks for 3 days. And the reason it's in there is so that the legislators can actually read the bills before they vote on them, or at least have the opportunity to do so. Right. Under the governor, though, under the Constitution, has emergency powers to issue what's called a message of necessity, which basically short circuits that 3-day requirement. Bills can be voted on a nanosecond after they show up on the lawmaker's desk. And that's how the budget was done this year.
And the message of necessity, Blair Horner, was so that if Niagara Falls dried up or the sun didn't shine one day.
Exactly. Something that's a real emergency. And the emergency here was they were afraid they didn't want the budget to be out there in public view. So it was bad in that way. I mean, the advantage of the budget was the state was sloshing with so much money from federal aid and increased tax revenues that, you know, every program basically was getting additional support. They may not get as much support as they necessarily needed, but they got more support. I'll give you a classic example is the funding for higher education. It's what was finally approved is probably the best budget for higher education in decades. Yeah. And yet it falls far short of what higher education needs. So, you know, the positive side was it was a lot of money and they were able to squirrel some of it away in reserves. The downside was the process was an insult to sausage making.
Well, you and I are very concerned about climate change, what it means to all of our relatives and everybody else. So this budget didn't do anything there or much.
Yeah, I mean, the whole sort of environmental strategy. I mean, there was bills that passed, of course. So, for example, there were new protections for wetlands to protect them from development that passed in the legislation. That's been kicking around for years, so that got done. But really, the central organizing principle of what's going to happen on climate is going to be contained in the $4.2 billion Environmental Bond Act, which will be on the ballot this November. And if it's approved, there will be some resources in there to do things like for schools to buy electric school buses. And some money available to the state for environmental, you know, mitigation and adaptation to climate change. The storms are going to get bigger. The sea levels are going to rise. You're going to have more flooding in the subways in New York City. That's all going to cost money. The problem is the $4.2 billion is not even anywhere near enough. Experts say that unless something happens with climate change, the state's going to be spending upwards to $10 billion per year to deal with the costs of the big storms and air conditioning for schools and all that other kind of stuff. So it's a big problem. It's a big financial hit. The state is not really putting enough into it. Some of the big ticket items that were going to be considered, one was that, you know, in the future, all buildings would have to be constructed relying on electric power, not natural gas or oil. Mm-hmm. That got kicked to the side. We'll see if anything happens on that by the end of session. So the big ticket items were sort of moved out. The Environmental Bond Act was the centerpiece. But if it gets voted down, the state has basically done very little, if anything, to deal with the existential crisis posed by climate catastrophe.
Well, Blair Horner, higher education, you already mentioned that a lot of money came in, as you also said, well, not enough, but a lot of money came in for higher ed that we haven't seen before. How are they going to spend it? Are they going to waste it?
I hope not. I hope not. The state is essentially making whole some of the holes, different word, the same word, different spelling, that was created in public college budgets by the Cuomo administration when it created the SUNY 2020 and basically said that the colleges had to eat the costs of financial aid for the poorest students, or some of the costs for the financial aid. So that hole has now been plugged. The state will provide the money, and so the schools won't need that. But so many of the schools are teetering on the financial brink, they didn't provide enough. So, for example, just this week, Erie Community College was talking about having to maybe close its doors because of the fact that it just doesn't have the revenues. And a lot of that is due to the plummeting enrollments all across the board and the state not filling in that revenue loss. Like if a bunch of college students don't go to a particular college, you don't have the revenue, and yet the buildings are still there and the faculty's still there and the parking lots still have to be shoveled in the snow and all that kind of stuff. So the state really hasn't done anything about it, even though you make a very good case that higher education is probably the single best economic investment the state could make.
Let's talk a little bit about the Buffalo Bills and the stadium out there. You know, a lot of people don't like the idea that we're forking out so much money to build a new stadium in Buffalo. And, of course, we have a governor from the region, and people are pointing fingers at her. I personally think that is going to cost her should she get a substantial opponent anywhere along the line here.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. I mean, the Buffalo Bills happen to be the only New York football team. The two that say they're from New York are actually based in New Jersey. If I was the political person in charge of our operation, and I had a magic wand, I would have had that deal come out when the Bills were in the playoffs, not when baseball season was starting. But you're right. I mean, it's the most lucrative public subsidy of any NFL stadium in the country. The owners of the Bills, the Pegulas, are billionaires, so they certainly have the money.
And they don't live here, right? They don't live in New York
State.
They
live in Florida, and because they don't have to pay taxes to New York then. And so it stinks in all of those levels, but it would have been a political catastrophe if the Pegulas moved the Buffalo Bills to some other city outside of New York. You know, Buffalo's a small city. The weather's not so hot, although for some reason, even though they're spending all this money and they're not putting a cover on the stadium, I don't quite understand what they're spending money on, but whatever. Let's just assume for the moment it makes some sense. It's not, you know, the greatest place to play if you look at it in terms of a market. And so the Pegulas could easily think about moving to somewhere else where they could make more dough. And that would have been a catastrophe for the governor if the Bills even made noises that they were going to lose. Talk about having a weapon for a formidable political opponent. That would have been one.
And Blair Horner, who we are so thankful to have on the show this week, let's talk a little bit about bail reform. That's a big one, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that at the end of the – what slowed down the budget was the governor's jamming in last-minute items to the budget negotiations. One was the almost $1 billion or more than $1 billion in public subsidies for the Buffalo Bills stadium. And the other was her attempt to sort of change the state's criminal justice laws with regard to bail. And there's been arguments, you know, the public is unhappy because of, you know, public safety issues and rising crime in New York, by the way, also in the whole country. I think it's probably tied to the pandemic. But they felt like they had to do something. And the Republicans had used the issue of bail reform, which passed recently in the last couple of years, as a successful cudgel against Democrats, so much so that in a county like Nassau County, where Democrats had an enrollment advantage, the Republicans ran the table in the 2021 election. So there was a political threat. And so the governor moved these two things at the last minute, which slowed down, I think, the budget negotiations, created animosity with the legislature because they had advanced bail reform. Governor Hochul had nothing to do with it. And so it's a politically charged issue. It's a racially charged issue. And the substance, it's not so clear that, A, the bail changes made a couple of years ago are resulting in any sort of statistical increase in crime. And yet, on the other hand, it is, a political dynamite for the Democrats in terms of them getting blown up, not the other way around. So it was a very hot potato, very radioactive issue. And it looks like, anyhow, they threaded the needle enough that they feel, I think the governor feels like she can say she did something about it, but it's not entirely clear to me that anything substantial was done about it.
Well, we know a lot of the voters didn't like bail reform, whatever it meant. And as you say, it was used effectively by the Republicans taking on the Democrats. Now, what do you think Governor Hochul was putting herself into her place? What do you think she thought that this was an unpopular thing, that the public was perceiving this as meaning people were getting out of jail free, as they say, a monopoly, and she wanted no part of it, although it put her at some distance from the legislature,
right,
didn't it?
No, absolutely. The governor's proposal coming out at the last minute within the last 2 weeks of the session created real animosity with the legislative leaders because I think they believed on the substance that they were right, that they had advanced the changes a couple of years ago on bail reform, that they thought that they were right, and that they thought that the governor's analysis of what was wrong on the substance was incorrect.
Well, there's a political argument going on here. Look, the legislature, you know, represents people, and it looked to them as if people of black and brown skin were getting screwed. And they took the governor on, and the governor knew it was an unpopular position with white middle-class voters. Am I wrong about that?
Well, you're right that the problem is a political one, as far as I know, anyway. Again, we'll see. There may be substantive stuff out there. There's certainly anecdotal evidence of the occasional person who didn't have to post bail who went out and created additional crime, and that there's no challenge to that. But, you know, can you afford bail was the issue.
And absolutely.
That meant that well-off people could. So, for example,
right,
Brian Benjamin, when he was arrested yesterday, former lieutenant governor, he posted a $250,000 bond and he's out. But if you're poor, forget it. You end up in Rikers for sometimes a long time, even though you haven't even been arraigned. So it's an unfair system in that way. On the other hand, if people in particularly downstate, but in every urban area in New York and the country, are freaked out about the increase in crime, and they do not want public policy that they perceive as soft on crime. They want a hard on crime approach. That's what helped Eric Adams become mayor of New York City. And there's a lot of that. From people I talk to in the city, is a lot of real concern. And we saw it yesterday with the shooting in the subways.
Mm-hmm.
That is a real problem.
I want to go for a moment to redistricting. Obviously, the Democrats have redistricted New York so that they get more congressional districts and other legislative districts. Does anybody care?
Well, the Republicans do in New York State. This is the first time in modern New York history that one political party so dominates the scene that they are able to drive the redistricting process in terms of what the lines are drawn. And so there's, the Republicans challenged it in court. They're arguing that under the state constitution that these lines are done illegally. The lower level court has ruled in the Republicans' favor. The Democrats.
It was a Republican judge, I believe, who
that's right,
ruled
that's
that
right,
way.
That's right. And so they're going to appeal. And so, it's going back and forth. We'll see what the courts do. It's really hard to tell. I mean, I'm not in a position where we drew any maps. But last time around, 10 years ago, the Republicans controlled the state Senate and they drew the lines in the, famously gerrymandered way. And so for the Democrats to do anything in the state Senate, they're going to look better because of those existing lines. Congress is trickier because the state lost a seat. And 10 years ago, the lines for Congress were drawn by the courts. And last time around, New York had 27 congressional seats, and 21 of them were taken by Democrats. This time around, the line, there's 26 seats, and the Democrats have advantages in the lines that are drawn anyway, in 22. Now, where the lines actually end up really matter, and this is sort of a nano-level political issue, mm-hmm. because the lines, how you draw them through down some street and around somebody else's house can have all the difference in the world, and that's what the courts are going to figure out.
Blair Horner, one last thing. You've mentioned it before in this interview, but I want to make sure, because I think the rise in crime, albeit a rise that is reflected around the country, perhaps brought on by the pandemic, really is going to affect the politics of New York State.
That's right. I mean, the last time a Republican got elected statewide, and it was the first of three terms for George Pataki, the issue was crime. And then Governor Mario Cuomo's opposition to the death penalty. And while the death penalty's deterrence is hotly debated, but, you know, there's not a whole lot of evidence how much of an impact it has, nevertheless, the public was unhappy with the public safety, and it helped elect George Pataki. Now, you know, of course, fast forward now, you know, many years later, it's a little bit different. There's not a three-term governor. There's the first woman governor running against, and if she wins the primary, will be running against a Republican who will be using crime as an issue. But, you know, of course, the politics are very different. And, you know, how much this ultimately will matter probably depends more on what happens this summer than anything else. I mean, the public is really unhappy with the rise in crime, and the pandemic, I think, exacerbates the kinds of mental illnesses that lead to crime by, you know, much of the crime that we see, the violent crime that we see.
Blair Horner, we are so appreciative of your being with us, and I just want to say that. We are out of time. Our guest has been Blair Horner, the executive director of NYPERG. That's the New York Public Interest Research Group. Blair, thanks so much for joining us again. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Or visit us online anytime at WAMC.org, or you can even schedule a podcast. And join us again next week at this same time for another Political Conversation with Alan Chartok. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.